Malloy here. Time for another story and another trip through the Wind Door. So, I think we've covered most of the other topics. It's finally time for us to discuss the big question of the episode. That's right, listeners. The remaining 47 minutes of episode 11, basically the entirety of our part 2, is our thoughts about Catherine Holloway and how she is portrayed. I did not remember that we spent this much time on her. But way back when we were planning out our episode on Chapter 13, many of the thoughts that I came up with were repurposed and expanded on for this episode. That should give you an idea of what we were working with. So this is going to be a lot, and we hope you're here for it. Okay. We like to talk about Catherine as a hero. And indeed, she is generally one of the more laudable people in the story of New Century.
Certainly positioned as a mentor.
Yes. It's not really a spoiler to say Alex very much believes in the economy of characters, so Catherine is going to reappear in later stories of New Century. And for those of you that have already read this far or don't mind being spoiled, there is an episode of White Scar's team-up with Catherine's voice actress talking about the oeuvre of playing her, available in the Through the Wind Door feed now or soon after.
Mm-hmm.
The question that I put to Toby originally, and that I now put to you listeners, is, did Catherine fail James and Abigail in those early days? It's certainly true that Catherine had the larger group to think of, and therefore her world did not circle around these three young people. But the flashback chapters span the length of 7 months, all told. She knew that Abigail was a problem ever since Doris, and she tried to keep a lid on it just from forbidding her to leave. She didn't make an effort to reach out to either of them after the fact, nor did she have anyone else do so on her behalf. In point of fact, while we are told that there is this staff that is assisting her and Beauregard with the maintaining of Weirwood and teaching the young people, we never actually meet any of them besides Nathan and Dr. Potts. Maybe she didn't have anybody that was trained in the matter of psychology or being a therapist for children or anything like that, but there's no indication that an effort was even made. In retrospect, this take is not entirely fair. I did a little digging, and the beginnings of psychology even being a thing in the U.S. started around 1875 with a Harvard physiology instructor named William James. Sigmund Freud himself started using his case study technique in the 1890s. Psychology as we know it would have been thoroughly disrupted by the Wendigo Plague. That doesn't mean that someone couldn't have realized this was going to be a potential issue and tried to reach out to the teens, but it's also true that Catherine or anyone she would have had to hand would have been ill-equipped for this. So, it's my fault for trying to apply modern standards to this particular situation. On top of that, we also have some of the ongoing threads that we found on the way of discussing these chapters. Nathan, for example, he lives in this shed, which is far apart from Weirwood itself. It's very spare. It apparently has one nice chair in it, and not much other than that. But he lives apart from everybody else. Potts would seem to live in Weirwood, and the other members of the staff, however many there are, would seem to live in Weirwood. Nathan isn't there. Now, one could potentially understand that in the wake of the Civil War and the fact that, you know, there are adults that might end up feeling the same way as Doris did, that this might have been for Nathan's own protection. But there's a dual narrative there which has conflicting information. You pointed out that Nathan is sent as the emissary of Weirwood to collect the children, which would seem to speak of her trust in him, but she does not attempt to integrate him with the rest of Weirwood, which, especially when you're dealing with a lot of impressionable children, would feel to be the way towards avoiding events like what happened with Doris painting the N-word on his shack wall.
It certainly could, and I think is something that feels like a step where she respects Nathan enough to have him be an emissary of Weirwood, someone who collects the children and takes them back and is a part of this establishment. But it could also be one of those things which is a half step towards progress, mm-hmm. where Catherine is ultimately someone who comes from the South, and she was in a position of high nobility and authority, as we will discover about her backstory in Cartographer's Handbook. But even so, you never really get the impression that she would hold anywhere close to what Doris expresses in these chapters. It is something which feels like it's not a priority for her to advance Nathan's station or her correct the opinions and attitudes of these children. She really is positioning herself as the person whose sole responsibility is making sure that everyone survives this. As the Wendigo's outside my door remind us, there are dangers out there. And so it becomes this thing where we have to question that. And it's also possible that it is entirely to Nathan's preference that he is apart from the others. If he doesn't feel safe around these other people, as he says, then he probably is only too happy to have his own space that is away from them. That is not necessarily meant to excuse her actions. It's just another factor to consider.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point that I hadn't considered until you said it. So Nathan's agency on the subject may be playing a part of whatever it is that's going on. The problem is that none of it's made explicit, so this is why we are filling in the unspoken parts with our own concerns on the overall subject. Toby has brought up the important point here, but I also know that neither of us can speak adequately on the subject. Mind, the subject of integration would have been far more important if Weirwood's population was more diverse overall. If there were a number of black children also present, for example. The explanation of why it was not is alluded to in the Cartographer's Handbook, and the topic of integration itself is addressed in Arlington, so for the moment, it's enough for us to move on from here. It's not like we're putting Catherine on trial for civil rights violations. This is just surrounding detail in a story that focuses on our protagonists. As mentioned before, one could always imagine the world you want to live in, not the one that is. Considering how much has changed in 2013 when this began, maybe Alex could have made different choices if he started writing these stories now. But art also tends to reflect reality. People that have been following along with Uncivil Outlaw can see the parallels there, and also know how the events of 2020 impeded progress on Stone Spring Maidens. I don't think that Catherine's view towards black people is her biggest failing point, because it is gone over the top of very quickly. She apparently does put Doris to task, but she doesn't do it in front of everybody else. And in order to keep the peace, perhaps just to prevent Doris from doing more unwise things. She also has Abigail apologize to Doris, which would seem to be an effort towards keeping the peace, but obviously it just makes that one moment where Abigail is looking for the safety of her friends, doesn't find it because it feels like they've moved on without her, and leads to her almost making the rash decision of trying to leave Weirwood. But let's put that aside for the moment. Let's talk about the larger picture of how Catherine responded to James and Abigail's situation, and the fact that she did not apparently make any effort to quell the potential roiling tide of what would eventually blossom into an act of defiance in order to protect the girl that both of them love, which ultimately ends in tragedy. Her response immediately after this, I mean, first of all, she has to take the necessary act of removing the threat of Wendigo Lucy from the situation. But of course, she couldn't do that in private because they had already found her. All she could do in that particular circumstance was act quickly. Mm. But when she gets to the aftermath of it, of the funeral and everything, she has a moment of expressive empathy for James, hugging him, but she also says, I have to keep the two of you apart now, and you understand why. James fills that in a little bit with his own interpretation of the situation, mm-hmm. but more importantly, regardless of what James chooses to do in response to Catherine reaching out to him, Catherine also makes the act of putting some physical distance between James and Abigail by taking on Abigail as her own personal student, is the wrong word? Apprentice.
Protégé.
Apprentice, protégé, both of those work. It feels a little bit like closing the barn door after the horse is gone, and maybe that's all that she could do.
Mm.
Maybe that's all she could have done at that point. But if she knew this was going to be she's not stupid. She knew this could be potentially a problem. She apparently did nothing to try and prevent it, either by reestablishing respect and trust between James and Abigail and herself, or having somebody else do that on her behalf. So when the two of them do what they do, which is distract her so they can get the key, so they can help Lucy get out, it is an act of rebellion on their part. They don't go to any adult authority to try and figure out what to do. They just summarily make a decision on their own behalf, and that is the biggest danger. That is what actually leads Catherine to separating the two of them.
Well, it's something which might be a bit of me inferring this rather than there being a lot of evidence to support this, but I think that what might be happening is that the rift has already happened, as you say. The damage has been done to the relationship between Abigail and James, so her taking this action is almost like she's just cementing the divide, that they will probably not speak for many months or even many years, or at least not more than necessary, even without Catherine's input. I think that what she does is almost like a temporary measure, or at least something which she knows she has to do for now. A lot of Catherine's actions are quite reactionary. She sets up Weirwood, she establishes these rules to help them survive and thrive, but she is there to establish a survival and react to new developments. When we see in Cartographer's Handbook another event that happened in the intervening years, when outside threats come to her doorstep, she has to react. When Lucy comes, she has to react. And I think that it wasn't just her taking a instant decision of, I need to deal with this because they've already seen and this is a threat. I think it's a point that, as Abigail says, this was the first time she and most likely a lot of the other children at Werewood had actually encountered one of these things. So it's almost a display for her to say, this is what this is, and this is what needs to be done. It's not done in a ruthless or cold fashion. It's just in a, this is what needs to happen now. I think that when she does this, because she sees the damage that has been done and the path that it's already heading in, and she has to kind of establish some new ground rules. And I am going to say that that does do some harm. It really does. And I think that what happened after that is that James and Abigail became her two most valued people over time. And so when she set them on this almost corrective path of, you two need purpose and you need to stay away from each other, at least for now. We don't know if it was temporary or if it was something she wanted to do for the long term, but she does it and it's for the foreseeable future. And then they both get really good at what they do. And the more that happens, the more that Catherine will rely on that, which just it just repeats the cycle that they are kept further and in their respective roles apart. She, Abigail, connects with all the other people and becomes a leader and a fighter, and James is the doctor, and over time it falls into place. But I think that when Annie comes to her doorstep, what's important to remember is that it is Catherine's idea to send James and Abigail. She has put both of them together again after taking them apart. And it, as you say, she's not stupid. She knows that they are probably going to gravitate towards each other as they'll be the only people they know in this new world. So it is actually grouping them really closely together. And I wonder if that is something she is doing to correct a mistake that she made, that she on some level realizes that this rift never really did heal. And a particular phrasing that I love from your notes is that Catherine says to James that you can be friends, but no more than that. And when we see the two later on, we see that they are even less than that, that they are not even friends. And that, I think, shows that this has gone in a way that she didn't want it to be like this, not like them never speaking. I think that there is some part of her that wishes that she could do something about this, but the more time has passed and the more she's depended on them, the harder that's been.
It would be pretty to think that she is sending them away for the reasons that Annie has outlined, that they are the best people that can help the cartographers do what they do, and that this is how she is showing her support for the government that she always hoped would come and finally did. Mm-hmm. And maybe she also hopes that by removing them from their roles here and sending them out into the world, perhaps the world can help undo some of the damage that she did when she was just trying to get everyone through the next day, the next week, the next month, the next year. By the same token, she also, part of that initial conversation with Annie is, am I sending these two to their deaths? So, you know, it's hard to say whether the two of them bridging the gap again would be the thing that would help keep them alive, because we're not going to talk about what happens on chapters that we haven't covered yet. But it's also just as possible that something worse could have happened in the interim, such as dying on Elkview Road back when people were disagreeing with each other, or just, you know, when they were investigating the Wendigo could have come on them and James would have been dead. So, you know, nothing is certain. And one of the things that Alex has talked about in the past that in order to make it feel like there are real stakes and that his heroes and heroines are in danger, then he actually has to put them in danger, and he can't necessarily guarantee an outcome where everybody comes out unscathed or even alive. He's not going to do that in his first book, because mm-hmm. this is just the establishing ground, and there's far more stories to come, more arcs to pursue, more alliances and adventures to have. But there is still that element here which is coined in Catherine's question to Annie.
Mm. And it's the one thing that is the linchpin on her, like, not sending these two, is that that is a real danger. And the fact that she asks Annie to promise her that she will, like, look out for them, mm-hmm. even though that she knows she's being selfish asking for that, and it's something which, as Butler points out, is something that she can't really keep following this promise for the whole of their military career or the rest of the time they're alive out here. But it is something that, even though it's unreasonable, she wants her to at least try to not only protect them and keep them alive as she has done all these years, but to look out for them. It carries this undercurrent of keep them as a pair. Not even that, but to, I'm struggling for the words, but it is to ensure that their well-being. Catherine, for as much as she has kept them alive, there are parts of their well-being that she has fallen short on.
Mm. And another thing occurs to me as I'm thinking more about that first conversation. One of the things that Annie says, speaking from complete ignorance, is that if James and Abigail stay, they can grow old, they can have families, they might have longer and fuller lives if they stay at Weirwood. And Catherine knows for certain that's not true, because she has grown up with these two people and can see that in James's case, at least, he will live and die chained to his doctor's tools. And while Abigail will probably continue to thrive in the role that Catherine set for her, she will probably never get close to anyone again without some outside intervening force like she did with James and with Lucy.
And she also knows that Abigail wanted to leave once upon a time, so she knows that there is something out there that there is an unfulfilled thread in her life, and I think that she's not necessarily sending her out there so that she can follow it. I think that's entirely Abigail's motivation, but with Catherine, I think there is a certain sense that she knows she can't keep them here.
Mm, yeah. One of the further things that may be on Catherine's mind is that Annie and Frank might be able to provide personal mentoring that she couldn't possibly provide. Sure, Catherine took a hand in molding Abigail, but it seems just as likely that she understood that new voices, in addition to new experiences, were needed to break Abigail and James out of their familiar patterns. One of the truisms about parenting is that we can't always accept the advice of our parents due to the emotional hang-ups we have about them. One of my favorite quotes is that parents push buttons like a peyote dealer working straight commission. And absent their real parents, that's basically what Catherine is to them. If new wisdom and guidance is to come, perhaps it has to be someone else that gives it. There was another moment that I wanted to get into, which I feel like we've covered a little bit, but let's clear away the earth a little bit more. Catherine is keeping James and Abigail apart because they are bad for each other. And I was posing to you, what does that actually mean? Because it's not something that's ever really gone into. But you also rightly pointed out that these were not Catherine's words. This was James's supposition, and Catherine simply did not gainsay his assertion. So let me ask you, are the two of them actually bad for each other? Are the two of them actually bad for each other based on what we have read so far in Secret Rooks?
I was about to say I cannot say too much about their future. At this point in the story, it is difficult because everything so far in the present, in the non-additional chapters which have delved into James and Abigail's past and their shared past, they haven't really been together as a unit. They have just been two people who have known one another and have one or two things to say about the other, but have not really interacted all that much. So we can't realistically say from that side of things anything about whether they're good or bad for one another. It's neutral. They've not been given the chance. It's all entirely about the events of these four chapters that we're looking at today. That is all the evidence that we have to draw on, because, you know, we had one chapter before this actually comes to mind where Abigail drank the drink offered by the doctor, when in their scenario, even though like Catherine and Potts would have known that there's nothing dangerous about this situation, but from their point of view there was a certain level of uncertainty, and they kind of enabled in one another. That sort of forgets the fact that Lucy was the one that steered them into that situation to begin with.
Yeah.
But it was Abigail and James who took action. And
Abigail being headstrong but canny, and James being intelligent and therefore being able to recognize the ingredient as being a harmless component of sarsaparilla, which is basically the Wild West soft drink. And the future sponsor for our next episode, Sarsaparilla Soft Drinks. When you want to ensure Emmett Brown doesn't fall unconscious because he can't handle his liquor.
But that's the thing, is that they propel one another to action, because between the two of them, between your brains and my brawn, we can rule the world. But it's this, they have so much ability that they really can accomplish so much. James is able to deduce in minutes who the culprit is of this terrible crime, and Abigail is able to run up to her and deck the fucker. In my mind, I see this as a great success, but it's something which to Catherine is like hugely disruptive. And these people not only are able to accomplish these things, but they propel each other to act on their sense of justice or their sense of what they ought to do. As someone who is trying to stay stationary, that is something that she kind of looks down on, these people who are propelling forward, using each other as rocket boosts. And so in that situation, as much as I respect what Catherine is trying here, I think that they actually demonstrate their super ability to as a pair. So they're not bad for each other there, I really don't think. And yet you see the sort of decisions that they make revolving Lucy, and you see them deliberate for a long time. And it's not just down to Abigail and James, it's Lucy's choice as well. And if they hadn't intervened, then she might have actually, like, even if she hadn't had the key to be able to get out, she most likely would have found some way to get out and probably run across the same situations.
Or not. We do actually have to consider the possibility that without the help of James and Abigail to subvert the safeguards in place, Lucy might be alive today because someone might have caught her. I'm not saying Lucy isn't capable, but I am saying that maybe part of the issue is that James and Abigail are a little too good at synergizing their strengths.
But at this point, we're arguing semantics. The point is that James and Abigail are able to get one over of Catherine by getting the keys and getting them back to her after they've accomplished what they set out to, again, showing how much they can do together. As this is all their sort of abilities and things like that, their personality and how they affect one another, it's hard because
it has yet to be tested.
Exactly. It's yet to be tested, and I think that Catherine is kind of scared to test it further when it's like she's trying to do damage control and see that, okay, these two have shown that they will go on their own and make decisions. I kind of have to step in and act now when they're at the most like recipient of the fact that they may not always make the best decisions and take action that establishes a certain level of control over the situation, put them apart and focus on their survival. But as you mentioned before, it's James that says that they are bad for one another. And of course he's going to say that. Of course that after suffering like the worst day of his life, arguably one of the worst days of his life, and after hearing Abigail say this will never not be our fault and not disagreeing with her,
The guilt is
that
overwhelming.
the guilt is overwhelming. And so the fact that he has more or less agreed by not disagreeing with Abigail's assertion that they share responsibility for this, and not only like that, but sole responsibility for it, for the worst mistake that they have ever made jointly together, it is only natural that his logical conclusion is the way we can prevent us ever making this mistake again is that we never make a decision together again. Because when we did before, we did this, and this is awful for both of us. We are bad for each other because we give ourselves the ability to take action and make our decisions, and we have just seen where our decisions got us.
Yeah. On a lighter note, to use a little bit of movie meme, Catherine is over on one side going, "I am the law," and Abigail is over to one side going, "Law."
I just say Catherine go, you betrayed the
So, yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the conversation between Rebecca and Cleo, which is already on my mind because I've been editing episode 3, where each of them is taking responsibility for something that happened, and maybe it's neither of their fault, and maybe it's both of their fault. There was a lot going on there. So Catherine is taking responsibility of some of this, but the thing that she has to do is she can't wallow in it. She has to take decisive action to prevent this from happening again. And she uses their guilt, the guilt that has already been instilled in them, to essentially facilitate that. Not because it's going to be good for them later on, but because she just has to restore order after tragedy.
Catherine is almost a perfect example of what I think of when I think of the phrase of I did the best job I could with what I had available to me. So that means she's not ruthless. She's not like what we will see Arlington be like. It's a case of she's a more neutral or like middle of the road. I don't like that phrase either, but you get my meaning. She is a less extreme version of Arlington in that she is doing everything she can to achieve the only thing that she feels she can achieve, which is the safety and survival of her people. And everything is second to that, or at least like it's something that can be addressed further down the road. And when it comes to this, she has to say, these two are going to be hurting, and I need to make sure that they know that steps have to be taken because of what happened here, and that's going to hurt, but this is what I'm deciding has to be done. I don't know if I can blame her too far for that. She is fallible, and I think that these chapters show what damage she has caused to these two over the years. A point that I appreciate is that there is at least some evidence in the text of someone calling her out on something and it never being addressed as, well, actually, she had a very good reason for this. It's when James is saying, Catherine had very short-sightedness when she put a group of teenagers with all these hormones together and was trying to enforce all these rules to prevent them from mingling with one another, to put it delicately. And it's never addressed that she had some like deeper plan, that she does probably have some rules that she is setting up which have kind of short-sighted. And that means that there are chinks in the armor, and that means that we have to judge her by her actions. Seems like we're being very hard on her. And to be honest, I think it's important that we do put her under scrutiny. But I think I've already said that Catherine did the best job she could, and that has kept these people alive. But at what cost? At what cost?
It's easy to look on a mentor figure as being all-wise and all-knowing. But Toby's words are truth. Catherine is really just like all of us. One person trying to do their best. It's only because this is a narrative that we look on Catherine as being like Uncle Iroh, or Nick Fury, or Minerva McGonagall. And yet at the same time, forgetting that even mentor figures make mistakes. One thing that I have thought on while editing this episode is the nature of people to only notice when something goes wrong. We can't know how many other times Catherine was taking care of problems off-screen with the many, many other employees or children under her care. Maybe she hoped that with Lucy as an ameliorating force, that the issues with James and Abigail could be resolved. She just hadn't considered that Lucy could be the center of the flashpoint. It's only after the fact, with the one person that could have contained their tendencies to act rashly gone, that Catherine could only take the final step of separating them in order to prevent further flare-ups of fire to tinder. Well, you know, she wanted to do something with the unusual amount of privilege that her property and the fact that she had loyal followers gave her, and she thought that the best way to achieve that would be by creating a safe haven in Weirwood. It's entirely possible that her eyes were too big for her dinner plate, and maybe she didn't necessarily know the scope of what she'd be taking on, and she now has regret for that in later life, because there does not appear to be anybody else that she is delegating to. She eventually delegates to Abigail herself, but that is much farther down the road. She is still taking care of Beauregard, who is barely there himself and manages to call upon his abilities as a soldier one last time in the defense of Weirwood. But there doesn't appear to be anybody else that are making high-level decisions, which means she makes them all, which means that we can't know the amount of stresses and pressures that she was under. Her world couldn't revolve around James and Abigail. So the idea that some things just sort of fell under the bus is, you know, how can we necessarily blame her for that?
Exactly.
It's not like she had a choice. This was already a difficult situation with the Wendigo outbreak to begin with, and she felt that she had to act quickly to build a bulwark to protect some lives, and therefore the softer stuff was going to have to fall by the wayside in favor of just hardline protection. Well, it feels like we've talked that subject out, but I want to at least briefly touch on the poem that James narrates for Lucy's funeral. I don't know anything about William Wordsworth. His is a poetry that I never really looked into before. And it's apparently part of a bunch of Lucy poems that Wordsworth wrote in, it looks like, very early 1800s. 1801, 1807, that era. The one that we're looking for, the title is literally the first line of the poem, I Traveled Among Unknown Men. And it's an interesting choice, obviously, because it is part of the Lucy series and is therefore titled Lucy and therefore would seem to be about Lucy. It seems to make it a natural choice for a funeral reading. Just doing a modicum of research reveals that the actual subject of it is the author suffering from acute homesickness, and he realized that he did not know how much he loved England until he lived abroad, and uses this insight as an analogy to understand his unrequited feelings for his beloved Lucy. In the poem itself, just as in Alex's story, Lucy ceases to be. So what's going on here, I think maybe it's touching a little bit on the subject that you in particular keep liking to bring back to the fore, is that New Century is a series of stories about being unable to go back to the world as it was. It's probably not as much that James is actually homesick for home, but he does mention in that last interaction with Catherine that my parents really are never coming for me, are they? And she says no, and he's like, good. And we don't dive too deep into what that actually means, particularly since it feels like a weird thing to say when he's being racked by the guilt of his decisions.
It's because James is, I think, racked so much by regret over like decisions he has made in the past. And I think that at that particular moment, what he wants more than anything is a certainty to move forward and leave it behind him. It's the sort of thing that he needs to come to terms and confront reality. And by him, he's saying good, not so much that my parents aren't coming and that means they're dead. That is not the thing that is good to him. It is good to him that he has finally admitted that. Because now he knows that his time here isn't going to draw to an end. And because he knows where his place is, he knows what he can do with the best of his abilities where he can.
Yeah. One of the things Wikipedia says about this poem is that the poem is filled with conflict and contradictions. And that feels like a very apt metaphor for what is going on in the story as well.
And in fact, that's exactly what Lucy and James bonded over in that intimate moment they shared together, is the contradiction that they explicitly call out of looking up at the stars, feeling insignificant, and yet that creates significance. And they bond over an appreciation of that contradiction. So for him to have a personal connection to her, as expressed and embodied by this poem, I think is very appropriate, that it would contain all these contradictions.
Yeah. Contradictions are a part of the human condition, for good and for ill. One of my favorite lines of poetry comes from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. Do I contradict myself? Very well, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. Well, as so often happens, we end on a final bittersweet note. I think we did a good job with the task that we set ourselves today, and that means that next time around, we are going to be covering
the final act of Secret Rooms, Part 4, A Strange Place. Part 4 will be divided into two episodes, and as before, that will culminate with a final episode that covers themes and thoughts on the book as a whole. The upcoming episode will cover chapters 18 through 20, because by the end of chapter 20, readers will understand why it is titled The Game Changes.
And hey, it's appropriate for the penultimate episode of what I'm calling Season 2 of Through the Wind Door, with these Secret Rooms episodes. We'll have a juicy cliffhanger.
Well, you know, there's cliffhangers everywhere if you choose to look on them as such.
Hey, that's a great life philosophy right there.
just don't be hanging from cliffs if you can at all avoid it.
Where's the fun in that?
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Well, we've had a lot of fun here once again through the wind door.
Have we been looking at the wrong different episodes here, Greg? Because I am bummed out after these episodes. I mean, they were great, but like, damn.
I think the overall point is that maybe we can't have fun without a little bit of the pain mixed in there. I don't know.
Swallow your medicine, kids.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to move swiftly along from that particular analogy because I don't want to delve too deep into what kind of pleasure and pain we're talking about. You know what? We'll see you next time on
Close the wind door. It's getting weird now.
Close the wind door. End of podcast. Over. Bye.
Take care.
And with that, another Indigo Girls song to cap us off. From what I've been able to research, Emily Saliers and Amy Ray came out as explicitly as lesbian in 1994 with their fourth hit album Swampophilia. But this one song from their third studio album I feel is definitely about some teenage lesbian relationship that went south. The idea of it being secret is dropped twice in the lyrics, and that dovetails with the way Abigail and Lucy tried to keep their own experiences secret. The ghost in the song is likely more figurative than literal, but this was a song I had in my brain ever since I first read Secret Rooms. Tell me you can't hear a line like, "As I burn up in your presence, and I know now how it feels to be weakened like Achilles with you always at my heels," and not think of those two. For God's sake, it's even got a Greek reference in there for the woman once named Athena in Alex's old drafts. Until next time, listen with me at this tearful ballad, Ghost.
There's a letter on the desktop that I dug out of a drawer. The last truce we ever came to from our adolescent war. And I start to feel a fever from the warm air through the screen. You come regular like seasons, shadowing my dreams. And the Mississippi's mighty, but it starts in Minnesota, at a place that you could walk across with five steps down. And I guess that's how you started, like a pinprick to my heart. But at this point, you rush right through me and I start to drown. And there's not enough room in this world for my pain. Signals cross and love gets lost and time passes. Fire willingly and dance the edge of sand. my spirit. I can't touch you. Can you hear it? A cry to be free. Oh, I'm forever under lock and key as you pass through me. Now I see your face before me. I would launch a thousand ships to bring your heart back to my island as the sand beneath me slips. As I burn up in your presence, and I know now how it feels to be weak and like Achilles, with you always at my heels.
The original opening for episode 11. I ended up removing it because, especially by the time this episode aired, it just wasn't funny anymore. I don't think anyone would ever hear anything I had to say and think I could ever be an edgelord, and that's the joke. But the way things have gone off the rails in 2020, I wanted to try and stick with wholesome humor. Welcome to a brand new episode of Through the Wind Door, Edgy Edition. Today we're going to be triggering the SJWs as we talk about sex, the N-word, and kicking prominent women off of their pedestals of power. No, I'm sorry.
Out. Could you imagine?
Oh yeah, all of a sudden this is Bizarro World, Greg and Toby.
we just take a peek through another window and go, oh no, not that one. This is my favorite conversation where we've talked about the N-word.
I'll let you in the world. We'll probably not have another one for a while.
Please, could it be the last one? Yeah. Oh no, Cartographer's Handbook.
We'll just brush very lightly over the top. This next bit is really only funny if, like me and Toby and Alex, you're a massive Eddie Izzard nerd.
Well, you've been doing it a lot more than me, man. I'll put it that way. And look after yourself. Take a break. Have a Kit Kat. All the usual steps I advise.
I'm not a assassin. All right, well, I have other things to get on to, and you have to go back and try and hit the Wendigo with the broom.
There was a boatload of them at one point, but, they sailed right past.
And so, therefore, James and Rebecca act in the ways that can be typically described.
James and Abigail, rather than Rebecca.
Okay, I'm sorry. I've been editing Let Them Go, so I have wrong names on the brain there. It's voiced by the same person. It's fine.
It's fine.
It's notable that of the three of them, Lucy also happens to be the most socialized. James is isolated due to privilege, family choices, and likely being I can't talk. It's notable that of the three of them, Lucy also... That's all, folks.